Thank you all for coming. I'm Naomi Marilis. I'm the administrative attorney at the Bethesda of America. I'd like to thank our panel for coming today. I'm going to start on my left. Josh Ross is the founder of ORA, which is the Organization for the Resolution of Ugly Notes, which we spoke about briefly this morning. Rabbi Kenneth Downman is Mordz Asrael Gan Yisrael Flatbush, as well as a teacher at Stern College for Women, and my Mesader Kedushin, a close friend of my family. And Michelle Greenberg-Cobrin is the Dean of Students at Columbia Law School, as well as a member of the Advisory Board of ORA. So the way that we're going to structure this today is I have some questions that I prepared for the panel. Obviously, you could all feel free to jump in. If we have time at the end, we'll open up to questions from the audience. However, there is a question-answer session after this session. So if there's not an opportunity for questions, hopefully there will be after this session. Before I start questions, I just wanted to give a brief background as to when official community pressure is comes into play in the area of recalcitrant spouse. Two different types of seiros, contempt orders, are generally issued by the Beis Din in a case of a recalcitrant spouse. The first would be when a woman approaches the Beis Din and says, I would like you to summon my husband, to send a hazmanah to my husband, to come to the Beis Din and give me a get, and we send out our three hazmanas and the husband doesn't show up. In that case, we would issue a seirah that basically says that this individual has not shown up to Beis Din after hazmanas have been issued, not to our Beis Din, not to any other Beis Din. And implicit in that type of a seirah are communal sanctions, however, it's not explicitly stated. The other type of seirah would be in a case where a husband does show up to Beis Din. The Beis Din rules that the husband is required to give a get to his wife, and then the husband does not give the get to his wife. In that case, very often, when we issue the seirah, we'll also have language that, as Rabbi Reis discussed earlier, discuss our chakot of Rabbeinu Tam, which would be situations where we would say that this individual shouldn't be invited to people's homes socially, they shouldn't be given any kibbutzim, they shouldn't be recognized in their community. In that type of a seirah, sometimes the Beis Din is more explicit. So though in those types of situations, when a seirah is issued, that is when official communal pressure is often appropriate. And I'd like to open up the floor first to Rabbi Aleman, just to ask in general what your experience has been with communal pressure, what types of experiences you've had.
Okay. So I've been in the Flatbush community, in the Young Israel Flatbush, for about 25 years. And when I first came there, I don't know how many weeks or months it was after I was there. There was a very, very tough situation of a recalcitrant. And at that time, there was really one of the, I guess, pre-organizations that was, in a sense you might say, maybe the grandparent organization of ORA, which was the GET organization. They were like the original group that was involved in this kind of communal pressure. And they had started, there were many of the people involved in the organization were from Flatbush, and there was a very, very difficult case that came and sort of was thrown into my lap as I sort of just was new in the community. And part of the difficulty with it is that we were demonstrating not against the recalcitrant spouse himself, not against the husband, but the husband's parents. Because the husband's parents had a business in the community, and they were supporting. They were supporting him financially. And I don't think he had any kind of a job. And in that sense, they had the ability to pressure him to give a get. So the demonstrations were directed to him. Now this was, as I said, very difficult for a number of reasons. First of all, there's some kind of a moral question. You know, do you go after, so to speak, people who are not the actual principals? Now these parents were not refusing to give a get. They were secondary. They were supporting their husband, their son, who was the recalcitrant husband. In addition to that, there were Holocaust survivors. There were all people we demonstrated outside the store on Coney Island Avenue, Sunday after Sunday, for a number of weeks. And it would break your heart, because out would come these old people who clearly had, you know, lines of worry etched into their faces, and they would say, "What do you want from us?" And we would say, "Get your son to give a get." Eventually, it was resolved. He did give a get. Unfortunately, I think shortly afterwards, that store went out of business. Now, and it makes you feel sort of very, very bad. On the one hand, you know, here you are, you're doing something you think is right. You have principles. On the other hand, you have these nebuchs, these old people, these people who really went through a lot in life and have to suffer this as well. But, you know, sometimes you have to be a little bit, I don't want to use the word hard-hearted, but you have to look at the general overall picture and see the suffering of the woman, and you just have to balance that and do what is felt is the right thing. So that was like, I think that was my sort of trial by fire, you might say, into this whole issue, which really I had never experienced on a first-hand basis before. Because although I had been a rabbi of a community for a few years before that, it was in a small out-of-town, relatively out-of-town community, and these issues didn't really come up much there. So that was my introduction. But even though the community was mostly supportive of this, the problem was that there were relatives of these people who were in the community. And what always happens is a very unfortunate thing, but it's normal human nature, that everyone is always in favor of, you know, being tough on a recalcitrant until it's someone who you know, or until it's someone who's your friend or your relative. And then people start coming, "Well, how can you do it in this case? How can't you?" And the rule has to be, and that's, I found, that if one follows it consistently, then it really works, so that if there is a seiruv from a Beis Din, then it has to be honored by the community. And if the community is educated to know that and to believe that, generally these things have a chance to work. I don't want to hog the floor. So that
just had a quick follow up question for you. In a case where a member of your particular shul is the recalcitrant spouse, would you contact other rabbis in your area and get them involved as well, or do you keep it within your own synagogue generally?
It would depend on the situation. If he was davening exclusively in our shul, and we were able, and the shul, by merely pressuring him in terms of the shul, threatening to announce his name in shul, that if that wouldn't work, fine. But if we see that he's leaving and going to another shul, of course we would contact. There was a case not long ago that Josh Ross was, and Ola was very, very much involved in, with a man, are you planning to speak about that case? Of a man who was really married to his second wife, and he had never divorced the first one. I was like, absolutely. I heard about it, and I said, the man was not a member of my shul, nothing to do with my shul, but I said, it's a few blocks away from me. How can we have this going on right under our noses here in Flatbush, and let somebody like this get away with this? So I spoke to a few of the rabbanim in the neighborhood, and with Josh's help of he organized it. Josh does all the hard work in these cases, and we had demonstrations. So again, even though it had nothing directly to do with my shul, but it was someone in the neighborhood, and we got a few rabbanim involved, and it eventually worked. It was a great deal of heartache, but eventually it worked.
Well, speaking of Ora, Josh, if you can give us a little bit of the history of how Ora was started and the type of work that Ora does on a regular basis.
Before I start, I want to make it clear that everything that Ora does is really common sense. The founders of Ora were Sizem students with below 3.5 grade point averages. So everything I'm about to say isn't really new. It's something that we have to take the time and effort to actually implement. Ora was founded when we were, it was my roommate and myself, we were in a shiur, and one of the rabbanim in the shiur actually asked us if we'd be willing to actually have a demonstration in front of someone's house who refused to give the gift for 11 years. And at the time, we just came back from Israel, we didn't know what an Ibn was. When we learned what the tragic situation, we decided, you know, we'll be naive, we'll have a demonstration, and hopefully it'll help. So we had one demonstration. To Rabbi Alman's credit and to Rabbi Alman, they showed up with their children, I think. We brought five guys from YU, it was in Arab Shabbos, and we started demonstrating, and it was in the heart of our heart. And I realized right away, more important than actually demonstrating and making sure that the husband knew what his obligations were to his current wife, who was a woman for 11 years, it was to educate the community. Every single person in that entire block was more religious than I can ever imagine. And not a single one ever said anything, never stood up, never said, never cared. And very quickly, everyone started going to the streets, wondering what was going on. The husband finally came out. We walked with him through the streets. Took about an hour. We threatened him that we're going to keep demonstrating what works. He said we don't know where he works. We told him what we do know where he works. The next day we went to where he works, and that's where the shocks kept on coming. We demonstrated in front of a happened to be a nut house. Literally, they manufacture nuts. And the husband was there that day with a Hasidish woman who owned the store. Said in 7 years I employed this man, no one ever told me he wasn't getting a wife again. And within a couple of weeks, the husband gave the guy. And that was sort of the basis for how it started. It was a common sense task that was never taken upon by any institution or any organization. There are people sitting in this room that I recognize who do these on an individual case-by-case basis, but the ultimate goal of ours is to ensure that A, our organization is no longer needed, and B, that communities take it upon themselves to actually implement the simple steps that are required so that these things don't have to happen.
Okay, Michelle, just following up on what Josh was just saying, things like going and protesting, going to somebody's employer, can you discuss any possible legal risks that might arise or libel suits or anything that, you know, potential risks from a legal perspective?
So I've been involved with ORA since they were incorporated in 2002. And essentially, this is, in a way, an easy question to answer, right? In the United States, anyone can basically sue anyone for anything. And many people do, right? If you spill hot coffee on yourself, you can actually sue McDonald's who sold you the coffee and make money, right? This is the tort system that we have, and it's good for me because I work at a law school and it keeps our graduates fully employed. So that's the nice part. The downside is that an organization like ORA is clearly, you know, opening themselves up to upsetting people who then will look to the civil court system for redress. I would say that everything that ORA does particularly, and that I think are common sense steps that Josh is advocating, and Jeremy, I just want to point out Jeremy Stern, the current executive director of ORA, who I think is here somewhere. Everything that they do is really perfectly legal. It's perfectly legal. It may not feel nice. It may not feel appropriate. And in many ways, it violates sort of our own American sense of staying out of other people's business. There's this very much deep ingrained sense that if there's something sad or tragic or complicated going on, we don't want to take sides. We don't want to get involved. There must be another side to the story. And so we tend as communities to disengage from this. And maybe I'm categorizing that way, and maybe what it really is our own goodness in staying away from things that seem like lashon hara. I'm not sure that as communities we do that, but I think that's a piece that's complicated, that we feel we can involve ourselves. And I think there's far more room legally and socially to involve yourself in these things than we might otherwise think possible.
Okay.
Can I add to that?
Oh, please, yeah.
I just want to add to what Michelle said. It's a very, very important point. People are very often, they don't want to get involved in fights and in machlokas and anything like that for good reasons. It's a very, very, but in this case, it can be very, very problematic. And that's part of the problem. Sometimes you demonstrate on a block and the neighbors, like Josh gave the example with this case, they don't know anything. Or even when you tell them what's going on, they say, I don't want to get involved in this. I'm not interested in getting involved. And it's really something that only good community education can overcome.
So I'm actually going to follow up with another point based on what Ravan said. So there was this case where the executive director of a very, very well-regarded, broadly well-regarded organization that operates in the Orthodox community, we found out that his son wasn't giving his wife a get. Luckily, it was 6 weeks before the annual dinner, and the invitations had gone out, and on the invitations are those long, long lists of the chair people and the tribute committee and the committee in formation, right? So there's a good 50 names, right? It was one of those good invitations on that list. So on the one hand, you don't want to do anything to harm this good organization that is doing extremely important work in the community. On the other hand, it is very clear what the most obvious clear pressure point is at this moment. And then the question is, how do you balance those, which Rabbi Allen spoke about, and also whether it's appropriate to insert yourself here? So we started calling, and I called a friend of mine who was on the tribute committee. And as you may imagine, he's not on the tribute committee because he had been deeply involved in the organization for many years. Yeah. Like most people, he was very good friends with the guy being honored. He was wealthy, and the guy being honored asked his wealthy friends to be on the tribute committee. So I said to him, can you make this call? Can you call the executive director and tell the executive director that we are going to protest at the dinner? We're going to protest this dinner of this nice organization that does nice things. If he doesn't give his son, if the executive director doesn't make his son, who he was supporting, give his wife a get. And after enough of those phone calls, the get was given immediately prior to the dinner. So this is, again, an instance where you're calling people, and this is one of the issues with communal pressure, is how do you get to the real stakeholders, and how do you get to the pressure points? And very often, the pressure points are not the people we want pressure, and they're not the people who have created the situation. But they're the people who can be influenced. And making those phone calls is uncomfortable, and asking those people to involve themselves is incredibly uncomfortable, and for many of those people, involving themselves is uncomfortable. But I think a piece Josh spoke about, it also serves as, in many ways, community education, right? When a community, in Rabbi Alman's community, they know that Rabbi Alman's face will be at those rallies. And I think then the community sees this as a teaching moment, right? Lo sim kan bim komenu. This isn't what happens in our places. And so there's a way that it can broadly serve as education, even if in some instances not always as successful as we would like it to be.
Okay, well, you actually just spoke about two very successful stories. So Josh, I was wondering if you could share with us a situation where Ora was involved, or you've heard of stories where, unfortunately, the communal pressure did not work.
Many stories like that. Community pressure works to the extent that the community is involved. So communities where there's a strong presence of providing people and leaders who care, these problems don't arise as often. Typically that we found, and there's no studies to prove this, that in more modern Orthodox communities, these problems aren't as relevant. They do occur. Sometimes they're not spoken about, but they do occur. But there are definitely times where you could rally and rally for years and years. In some cases, we've tried that, and it doesn't work. In the case of right now, it's in the Washington, D.C. area, which we've been in many, many demonstrations. The husband's kind of living with someone else. we try going through the children. We try going through his employer. He's actually a nuclear scientist. So we actually went through the Department of Energy. We used political pressure. The guy just didn't care. He lost his clearance. And this is the tragedy that goes on, and this is also to the credit of women who put themselves through these situations and don't abandon the religion and still raise the children in Orthodox fashion. It's to their credit. And I think if I was in this situation, I probably would throw the whole thing away. There are multiple cases where we've tried and certain things don't work. I think in the majority of cases, every single person, to an extent, has a tipping point. There's a family member. Sometimes that family member is a rabbi in another community, and once you make it clear to him that we're going to expose an entire family last name by association, it's going to affect his partner stuff. There are multiple ways of getting to any individual. They're never pleasant. They're never enjoyable. When we talk about demonstrations, we talk about this as absolute last resort. I've been in the car going to a demonstration. In the early days of ORA, we turned around and, midstream on the NASA RFK bridge, because we got word from our husband's colleague or associate or from his rabbi that he's reconsidering. And even on a 5% chance that they resolve amicably, we're not going to have a demonstration. But if there's a 5% chance that the demonstration will actually resolve the situation, we're going to have a demonstration, and we're going to keep on doing it as often as possible. There's a case going on right now in Florida where the wife's in Israel, and the community there took it upon themselves to have demonstrations. They got to the point where the husband's about to give the get, and his lawyer interfered and made some hula to indicate that it wasn't in his client's best interest at this time. And again, the negotiations go on, but the first step is to A, open up lines of communication. Make sure that people are speaking to one another, make sure that the differences that exist are known to both sides. We had a situation where it went on for years. The husband was actually going to prison for a white-collar crime. And for years, he was trying to extort the wife. And when we finally got to the meeting, the meeting occurred at midnight in a shul in Kibar Hills. If you know the husband wanted to, ex- well, I it's hard to say, he's still exploring her, but he wanted the money to go into a fund for his children because he wants to make sure they were properly supported with Jewish education. Still not, you can't do that, but once that became clear, a lot of the other issues that were really minor issues went to the wayside. Because it became clear, ultimately his best intention was to help his children. It's still not right, we're not justifying that, but it helped resolve huge differences in just one quick conversation.
You mentioned before that you've gone to the Department of Energy, so just a question about employers in general. Why would a non-Jewish or a non-observant employer care? If you go to an employer, why would they care if a husband's not giving a wife a gift?
I own a business myself, and I don't want some people standing in front of my business.
So you're saying just the demonstration itself.
The student association. Yeah, I can rattle off examples. For example, to put one in perspective, there's a series issued by a very respected Mason, and we contacted the husband, we asked the husband to give a gift. He repeatedly blew us off and said that he's absolutely no interest in this situation. It was tragic. His response was that he still loves her, and she didn't love him. And we said it's been 3 years, and she wants to go on with her life. She has someone she wants to get married to. And he said, I'm not interested. And we went back and forth, and finally we thought we had a meeting, and he didn't show up. At that point, we contacted his employer, who was Jewish, not affiliated with anything. He owned a perfume store in Bensonhurst Avenue. And we threatened him, so we're going to have a demonstration in front of you, so I'll let you stop employing this person. And he said, I don't really care. It's not going to affect my business. You know, you do whatever you want. So we showed up. And it was 10 guys. It was a number of years ago. It was an Arab kippur, which is an ideal time for giving up yet. And the husband wasn't there. We started demonstrating, and people started walking out of the store. And the employer finally came out and said, "What are you doing? You know, you're causing them to lose business." He said, "That's the point. We're here because what you need to support someone who refuses to give his wife a yet." And he understood what a yet was. And within minutes, he had the husband on the phone. The husband was saying certain unpleasant things to us. Eventually said, fine, I'll pick again, I don't lose my job, but I need you. Said, we're not playing these games anymore, we're not going to meet you anywhere, where can we pick you up? We didn't know where he lived. And we went to his house, we picked him up, we brought him to the sofa in Brooklyn, and as we walked into the sofa, the husband said, the sofa asked him the question, are you going to give your own free will? The husband and the sofa and the husband responded, absolutely not, so forced him to give it. And the sofa wisely responded, are they threatening physical harm on you? He said, no, he said, finish your own free will. And the husband gave it again, and since then the wife is remarried, and she has a child.
Okay, this is a question for the panel generally, so all of you can have that. You had any experience with a recalcitrant wife who has refused to accept the get, and in that situation, what have you done?
The answer is yes. It does go both ways. There are definite situations where a husband wants to give the get, and the wife doesn't want to accept one. Many times we found, and doesn't resolve all the issues, but many times, just the way society is, that women are more susceptible, I think, to pressure, and to date it's never ended up in an actual demonstration, although there are cases where I think it would probably be appropriate if the husband went to the appropriate channels and got the appropriate serum, but we definitely, it goes both ways. Just it happens to be, just from our experience, that most of our calls, by 95% of our calls, are from women who are trying to obtain get, not the other way around.
It's not just that it happens to be that way, but because of the system, the halakhic system, women are much more vulnerable to it because there are certain outs, even though they're very, very difficult outs for a man, but there is a heter me'er avanim, again, that's very, very, if it's done legitimately, it's very, very hard to really come by, but at least in theory, it is there. So it is much less likely that a woman is going to refuse a get than it is that a husband is going to refuse to give one. So, but it does happen. I once had an odd case where I had heard that a certain person was a somewhat distinguished person in the community was refusing to give a get. So I called them up. I said, "Are you talking? Can be a person like you is refusing to be?" He said, "I'm not refusing. I'll vote tomorrow. My wife doesn't want it. She's not taking it." So I called her. And I said, "Your husband said," he says, "Yeah, but I only want it if he's going to do this and this and this and this." So I said, "Yeah, but you can't say he's refusing." "Well, he's refusing to give it unless he does these conditions, unless I..." So it turned out that in fact, she was really the one who was making it difficult. Now in that case, he didn't want any pressure to be put on her, so there wasn't a question of demonstrating, but that was one case where it really had to, it was the woman who was not wanting the get that was being offered unconditionally to her. Eventually it was resolved.
So just 2 points. One, just of interest, there is an organization in Israel headed by Susan Metzger-Weiss that's very active on behalf of Avi Note, and one of the strategies that they're pursuing, which ORA has also started pursuing, is filing claims of tort in court, right, claiming damages for either negligent or intentional infliction of emotional distress. So it's actually a lawyer named Paul Gell, who was a classmate of mine, Rabbi Weissman's, who's in California, who's been doing that on behalf of ORA. And in Israel, they struggled with the issue as to whether they should file one of these claims on behalf of a man whose wife had refused to accept a gift. And ultimately, they decided to go ahead and do it because they felt that to be true to their own principles, and I think this piece is out there, you have to be honest about what the situation is. That having been said, get refusal is an act of abuse. It is very often not the first act of abuse in a marriage. Very often, this is the last or penultimate act of abuse in a history of emotional or verbal or maybe, God forbid, physical abuse as well. And it has to be recognized as such. And when you look at statistics of abuse, statistics of domestic abuse are 95% male to female and 5% female to male. And because that's just how it works in the big wide world, right? And that all is intuitive to us. And because of that, in the same way, the statistics, I think, parallel this, because I think they very much parallel general abuse statistics.
Okay, and another question to the panel. I guess general advice to women who are going through this, who are struggling, who are having difficulty getting a get from their husbands, other than obviously contacting ORA, what day-to-day advice would you give these women?
Is not always. It's many cases are like was just explained by Michelle that it's the final. It's the like the final act of abuse. But there also are cases where sometimes the mechanics of getting divorced themselves, the tensions escalate on both sides, and a husband may not start out with an intent that he wants to refuse to give a get, but it becomes a bargaining chip as each side, as the tensions rise on each side. So the first advice that I would give is that both sides, and depending which one is speaking to at the time, it is very, very important to keep the divorce process as quote-unquote civil as possible. Rather than right away try each side to engage lawyers and to start fighting with each other and upping the ante, it's good to recommend mediation at the beginning. If things are mediated at the very beginning, I think they have a general general likelihood of success and having what you could call, unfortunately, a successful divorce rather than a problematic one. Of course, if the husband is just an abuser to begin with, this is not necessarily going to help. But in cases where that's not the case, keeping the tensions as low as possible, I think, is a very, very important point.
So sort of piggybacking on Rabbi Allen's point, one of the issues with communal pressure is the timing of it. If you wait till after Seirut has been issued, you are far, far along into the process of from when that woman first wanted a get. And obviously, it's harder at that point to mediate an amicable solution. So this is totally, again, intuitive. If two brothers are in a family business and they get into a fight and they're not talking to each other, it's easier to reconcile them after 2 or 3 weeks than it is after 2 or 3 years. Right? After 2 or 3 years, the list of grievances has grown. The hurdle to overcome of having not spoken in all those years, right now, we didn't come to my son's bris, and this one farmer's, right? You know, you can imagine how much more difficult that is and how the parties become entrenched. That's one piece. The other piece is the act of being powerless over, or the experience of being powerless over your own future for women very often leads to very complicated emotional and mental issues, which is also perfectly intuitive to you. If I told you you didn't know when your life was going to work itself out, it is very, very hard to deal with that. And again, because we as communities tend to kind of disassociate ourselves from this, They tend to feel very, 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 very alone and vulnerable. So I think that leads to two things. You can start making phone calls beforehand, before the Seirav is issued. You can just call and say, why haven't you given your wife a get as a personal, you know, just as a person in the community, right? It's just another phone call. And you can call the woman in question and just let her know you're there for her, and you can call every week. And it's something that, you know, that I try to do. And it's amazing how grateful people are that you just made a phone call. And it's not necessarily someone that I know well, someone I just, or it's often someone I called up and introduced myself to. And I think that you can't underestimate that piece. Some sense that people know about them, that they're not forgotten, that you're there for support. And again, that you're willing to start asking the questions. Ora was just involved in a case where the Seirav had not yet been issued. The husband had committed a very heinous crime, but the result of the divorce. Now, there was plenty of pressure points. The husband's father worked in the Jewish community, and so on and so forth. And Ora just called a few people to let them know, who may not have known about this heinous crime that was in the public record. And they just kind of let them know about this, which the guy kind of tried to keep under wraps. And that get was given, you know. And this was a woman who at that point had suffered terribly for about a year and a half, although they weren't yet up to, they had issued several husband notes, but they weren't yet up to the Seirav. And on the parallel side, I was calling her other, and organized other people to call her and just to say, you know, hey, how's it going? How can we help? Those kinds of things. And I made sure, for example, she didn't live in my community, she stopped being invited for Shabbat, right? Like, people just didn't think to invite her for Shabbos lunch, it was so hard. Just little pieces like this actually make a huge difference in terms of that very terrible feeling of loneliness, and I think ultimately also in resolving cases before they reach the level where we need to ask people to come stand outside in the cold and shout outside someone's house.
I mean, everything that Rabbi Michelle said is absolutely correct. It's the first step is always mediation, or just trying to talk. Many very often find ourselves turning people away, saying, you're not at the point where you should even be calling over. I just find your local community rav and speaking with them about your issue. So, don't trust community rav. I can advise or recommend a handful. And wherever you are in the world, there are people that have dealt with this issue, that are talented in this issue. We're not talented at successful mediation. We're talented at getting people to go to mediation. And that's really the first step, or is contacting a respected basin to ensure that you reach the result according to Allah. It's not running to your lawyer and filing the suit. That only makes things worse, it complicates the halakhic issues. And from our end, when we get a case that's at the point where it's been years and years and there's no way of communicating, even before we just take the wife's word and it takes into action, we always contact the husband. We try reaching out to him through multiple channels. We try contacting his colleagues, his family members, his rabbis, his support, to see what is going on, what's the bottom line here that's causing this recalcitrance. And sometimes it's very surprising what you find. It's important to ensure that if you're going to get involved in a situation, that you go through the due diligence, there has to be a due process, and you have to know with guidance. A lot of agendas and guidance.
Thank you. I see we have about 6 minutes left, so if there are appropriate questions from the audience, if you want to raise your hand, we can take a couple of questions. Sir, back there.
What do you do with a guest who says, a lawyer's advice, I'm not doing the get?
On a lawyer's advice, I'm not doing the get. What would you do in that situation when someone answers on a lawyer's advice, I'm not doing the get?
Okay, so this is actually, I think, an interesting and very complicated question. There are many lawyers, even in our community, who say that they are perfectly comfortable serving as a divorce lawyer for someone as long as the guy promises to give the get at the end of the civil process. We all know that until the get is given, it serves as a bargaining chip. Whether you're talking about it, whether you're not talking about it, it's a bargaining chip. And it's a bargaining chip that under halakha is a stronger bargaining chip on the men's side than it is on the woman's side. So when the marriage is functionally over, the couple should be divorced la halakha. However, I have heard a counter argument. I think this isn't true. that, you know, lawyers have a professional responsibility to, quote, vigorously defend their clients. That's zealously or vigorously, depending on the state that you're in. And some lawyers have said, if I give up this bargaining chip, right, have I violated my, I've violated my requirement to vigorously or zealously demand this. Sort of having now spoken to a number of very high profile legal ethicists who are in academia, I think that this is a bogus argument. So I think you should tell them, you know, whatever your lawyer did or didn't, you know, advise you to do, right? You are a halakhic Jew separate from being your lawyer's client, and this is your obligation. And I think it can't be clearer than that.
Yeah, and Ben?
There are some lawyers that are known as the go-to people, lawyers who are part of our, you know, supposed community consider themselves to be permanent observers.
I learned at a very young age that it's not necessarily wise to go after lawyers. we have. Usually if the man's a lawyer, we're going after them. Those are usually very easy cases to resolve. It's easy. You can make, when it comes to dealing with lawyers, I mean, I tried my best when I was running the organization day to day not to actively engage with attorneys because whoever I was talking to, they were just billing their client, whether it was the husband or the wife, and then upsetting me. It's very important to recognize who the problem is in the case. I mean, a lawyer, you know, you could go to anyone for advice and they can give you good advice, but it still doesn't mean that it's right. And a lawyer who you're hiring is going to give you advice that's going to be in either the lawyer's best interest or you being the client's best interest. So when it comes down to it, ultimately, if the husband's acting on the lawyer's advice and it's contrary to halacha, contrary to our belief system, and as long as what we're doing is halakhically correct and within the civil laws, we're going to continue doing applying the pressure. And it's not an excuse to say, well, my lawyer said I can't do this. I know many of the lawyers, and the best and worst lawyers, they always take different sides depending on who's being paid. And that's the reality we live in, and it's a challenge. But at the same point, I think a common sense oriented person can make the right decisions without a lawyer's advice.
Yeah?
On the topic of bargainship, so for a woman who's an issue Clio, who doesn't have a profession or a degree, so it's a very scary situation to all of a sudden begin a stage in her life where she's not going to be able to share food for her own, and especially if she has young children. Why is it so wrong for her to ask what she's going to receive if she's going to receive a gift just for her own and for the next one? You're
thinking, maybe.
As far as I understand the question, it is, why would it be wrong for a woman who is may not have any outside sources of income to demand that she should, if she's going to be given a get, she should be given financial support as well at the time of the get. I think I phrased the question accurately. Obviously, look, every case is different and every case is unique. It depends who's in that particular case, for example, it would depend who is initiating the divorce. If the woman is initiating the divorce, then she obviously would have less of a claim to say, I'm entitled to certain things. If, on the other hand, the husband is the one who is divorcing her, and she says, look, I want to remain married. You want to divorce me, you should be able to support me. But being all that said and well, these are things that should be in any case. Whoever is, these should be things that are up to a beis din to decide. A get should be given regardless, and the beis din should decide whatever is the right thing to do in terms of, there could be times when a man is interested in and needs certain financial renewal, and they be coming to him according to the din. There may be other times when a woman needs it, but that should always be separate from the get itself.
Okay, yes, ma'am?
Going back to the question of the lawyers that are facilitating not a role for the community, possibly community leadership, preventive leadership, to be approaching these men or women who are really enabling?
I think Michelle addressed that before, that question, when you have an observant attorney who's telling his or her clients, you know, hold off the get until the end of the civil divorce. I think what Michelle was saying is that certainly that lawyer should and could be approached from, you know, by the rabbis or by people in the community to say this is not appropriate from a halachic perspective, regardless of whether or not you're zealously advocating on behalf of your client that the get should be taken off the table as a bargaining chip. Do you want to add anything to that, Michelle?
It's a problem. We've honored them at our dinners, right? I don't know what else to tell you. There are people who you call who are very, very good divorce lawyers, and they will tell you if it's an orthodox case, they are only the man's lawyer. They will tell you that. Flat out. That's a problem. It's then more of a problem if we honor them at our dinners. So again, this is just a question of this is just an issue of asking the question. You sit next to the guy in shul. Hey, what do you do when you represent an orthodox, you know, it's just at this Aguna conference. When you represent an orthodox person, what do you advise them about the get? Doesn't have to be a hostile question initially. Doesn't have to be a hostile question, period. People don't think to ask these questions on a broad-based level, and I think that's what Rabbi Amon, who has taken such an active role in this, and Ora are trying to maybe educate the community more broadly, right? Think about just the little ways in which you can make that difference.
Okay, that's the last question we're going to take, but we are having a question-answer session now with a different panel. I'd like to thank the panel for being very important.